Hello, everyone. This is M.R. Rangaswamy with Indiaspora. Today, I'm joined by Deval Sanghvi, who is the co-founder of Dasra. He's provided philanthropists with really impactful and intelligent investment strategies and has directed close to $50 million into the Indian social sector over the past 15 years. You might have also heard of the Dasra Philanthropy Week, which has engaged over 1,000 philanthropists, agencies, and corporate foundations that drive the philanthropy agenda in India. He also initiated the Dasra Giving Circle, which is one of India's largest collaborative giving platforms. You might have seen his articles in publications like Mint, Business India, and on television all around the world. He's also spoken at various global platforms like the Global Philanthropy Forum, etc. And he was also recently awarded the Forbes Philanthropy Award as a crossover leader in 2014 for successfully transitioning from a thriving career in investment banking to work for the nonprofit sector. We'll get to that in a minute. And so welcome, Deval, to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. So let's first start with your childhood and upbringing in the United States, and then we'll move on to India from there. So where did you grow up, and what was your early childhood like?
Sure. No, I was born and brought up in Houston, Texas. So my parents shifted, I guess, like many Indians in the late 60s. My father's an engineer by training, and so went to graduate school down in Louisiana, and then was working in the oil industry in Houston for a while. And so growing up, I guess, was there was a large Gujarati community in Houston. So would sort of grow up with those being sort of, I guess, my closest friends and so-called family out living in Houston, and just went to, you know, just the regular sort of schooling system over there.
Great. And then, so then you decide to go to business school, and then you kind of go on to become an investment banker. What was your thinking at that point in time, you know, before you got into this whole giving area?
Sure. So I went to University of Texas at Austin. I did my undergrad there, and I, as you said, got a degree in business, finance, and accounting. And I actually graduated a semester early to spend some time in volunteering with a nonprofit here in Mumbai, in India, and worked with the Street Children's Program that was in and around Grant Road Station, one of the major train stations here in Mumbai. And that, I think, allowed me to sort of get a firsthand glimpse on the many communities, unfortunately, that literally live on the pavements of India, on the streets. And going in, I guess I thought I would just sort of provide quite a bit of volunteer expertise to the organization as well as to the individuals, these children that we were serving. And I think very quickly realized it was actually the opposite, that these kids were teaching me much more about life than I thought I would actually be teaching them. So that experience was just absolutely phenomenal. Looking back, clearly life-changing, that I just realized that there was so much to do in the country, as well as sort of there's an appetite for just individuals who could be looked at as sort of the have-nots in India or even globally, yet there was this desire for them to lift themselves out of poverty, and very few people were giving them sort of that opportunity to do so. And so after sort of doing this experience, I went to Morgan Stanley, worked in New York for a couple of years, and I think realized that my calling perhaps was not necessarily making sort of millionaires richer, but enabling millionaires to sort of see the same impact that I saw in the short amount of time that I was in Mumbai, and really making that connect for them to fund and scale existing nonprofits in India to create greater impact.
Hmm. So when did that switch go off for you? You're at Morgan Stanley, you're in New York, you're having a great life, you know, making a ton of money for your clients and so forth. So when was that moment?
Well, it happened quite quickly, and again, sort of the dichotomy of going from being a poor college student to then being in India and really working with these communities, and then going into banking where you realize, you know, sort of you've never seen that kind of wealth or money in front of you ever in my life, at least growing up in Sugar Land, Texas. And so I think sort of literally within a 9-month period, I went to 3 different phases, from a college student to being on the roads of Mumbai and helping kids, and then going into sort of probably what was at that time one of the wealthiest industries around. And I think in going through all three, very quickly started reevaluating, I guess, my own value system, what I appreciated more. And while I had a tremendous experience in banking, and I think met and worked with some really smart, intelligent people who taught me quite a bit, I realized that those skills that they were teaching me were something that I felt, again, was lacking even more in the philanthropic sector in India. So it was actually after my sort of first year in banking that I started thinking about finishing my analyst position in 2 years and moving back and seeing what, or moving to even, since I never really lived in the country, but moving to India and seeing if some of those skills can be used to really uplift individuals out of poverty.
Mm. And, you know, it's such a contrast that we all go through as some of, you know, us who get to visit India quite often. You know, the whole image of staying in a 5-star hotel or a great area of Mumbai, and then just looking outside and you see a slum right next to this gorgeous hotel, right? I'm sure you faced that kind of a stark contrast as well in your decision process. And how did you reconcile, how do you still reconcile that in India?
Well, I mean, I think a couple of things, and again, this may relate to a lot of the audience that's listening to this program. I mean, number one, at least in the late 70s, there, you know, was a time in the U.S. where literally individuals would call from the airport, Indians, looking your name up in the phone book, and
right.
you would house them for an extended period of time until they found, you know, a place, a job, or they're sort of, you know, they're on their 2 feet. And so I think growing up, seeing those kind of values that we would demonstrate as a family and as a community to individuals who we didn't even know before, and then coming to India and seeing individuals living on the streets asking for money, and those same Indians that we would sort of take in Houston because they landed on a flight, yet when we were at a traffic light in an auto rickshaw, having this sense of, oh, they're in gangs, it's their fault, don't talk to them. I guess that dichotomy was something that really frustrated me as I grew up. And so every time I come to India, I'd want to do something. Every time I'd be told it's their fault. And yet in Houston, I guess growing up, any time an Indian needed some sort of support, the community would rally around that individual, regardless of their economic or educational background, et cetera. And so I guess for me, it was, why are we passionate or compassionate about some Indians and not for others? And so I think that was clearly a driving force to come out here. And I think after you start working with any of these communities, you realize the amount of compassion, again, they have for each other and for those less fortunate than even them. And so, for example, most street children in Mumbai or families that live on the streets will share their food with street animals, dogs, cats, et cetera. And you don't see the same happening with sort of the quote-unquote haves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think once you start working with some of these communities, you realize, again, how much they can teach you. And you realize while there's a dichotomy of the 5-star sitting, you know, close to the slum, chances are many times, unfortunately, people in the 5-stars are not necessarily as content with life.
Mm-hmm.
Or do they sort of have that sense of community that you see, for example, in rural India, regardless of economic status?
Yeah. So you decide to go to India. Was that a decision you made by yourself, or were you married at that time and was a joint decision? How did that come about?
Yeah, no, I was single at the time. I had met my now wife, Niranandi, at Morgan Stanley. So we actually met at Morgan Stanley. She's of Indian origin from Canada. And so we would talk about sort of, again, using these skills for philanthropy, for development in India. She was in mergers and acquisitions. I was sort of representing private equity and leveraged buyout shops at the time. And so we would talk about this quite a bit, yet I was sort of the first one to sort of take the plunge and saying, look, let me see if I can go out and if some of these skills were needed and can be utilized effectively in India. Neera ended up spending another year at Morgan Stanley, then went to Harvard Business School. So she would come in between summers and took a few months of sabbatical, but she didn't join until 2003, sort of 4 years later after I'd already been here.
So you go to India. So how did you get started with Dasra? Did you start it when you got there, or was this more of an evolution?
No, it was definitely an evolution. I mean, the idea was to scale social impact. I guess the brief experiences I had in volunteering with an organization here in Mumbai, I realized that there was a decent amount of systems and processes that one could put in place to these organizations to enable them to be more effective and access greater amounts of capital, thereby increasing their impact. At the same time, wanted to sort of get a sense of what was happening in rural India. So I had done some research, found some organizations to volunteer with, and spent some time in rural India, in fact, working and volunteering with these organizations to just, again, see if this model of providing managerial support actually was needed and could create impact. And I think after sort of being in different places like Mirzapur, UP, or Kharagpur, West Bengal, or even working with, you know, last year's Nobel Prize winner on child labor in Delhi and spending a little bit of time with him in 99, sort of 2000, it was clear that there was sort of this value of first doing a large amount of due diligence to find the right entrepreneur to back, and then providing that entrepreneur institutional funds or money for them to sort of build stronger management teams, invest in infrastructure like technology, office space, et cetera, enabling them to grow their programs and create greater impact.
So for a Silicon Valley guy like me, I got to look at Dasra and you as kind of the angel investor who does the initial work, scopes out the project, checks out the entrepreneurs and the ideas. And then, you then come to others for the next step, if you will, of this?
That's exactly how we started out. And one of the reasons for that is because we didn't know the sector well enough, and we didn't have that much expertise. So really the goal was to start with earlier stage organizations where, as you know, again, in Silicon Valley, sometimes just all hands on deck are required, regardless of the skills you bring to the table. And so we did start sort of with earlier stage organizations. This was again, this was now around 2000, mm-hmm. where we helped, for example, fund an organization called Magic Bus, where we were I'm a founding board member alongside, of course, the original founder, Matthew Spacey, and we were the first funders to them. In 2000, we also gave a $100,000 commitment to Akshay Patra, which was just on the verge of getting started. They were feeding about 1,500 to 2,000 children on a weekly basis, on a daily basis in Bangalore. And we helped them set up, in fact, their 501c3 so they can raise capital from the U.S. and enable donors to participate sort of in their growth and success.
Wow,
and so it was very early stage sort of funders.
Yeah, that must be so gratifying to find these young organizations and then see them become so successful later.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, just Magic Bus, for example, now works with close to 350,000 children and youth across the country, and then through schools and government programs, another 150,000. And so to be working with a cumulative of close to 500,000 children and youth on a weekly basis is just phenomenal. And Akshay Patra, again, you know, feeds close to, 1.5 million children on a daily basis and through their midday meals program. So, no, it's definitely sort of, I guess if I relate it back to Silicon Valley, it's nice to see some of these sort of organizations really become global leaders in their space and create innovations and technologies that are now not only adopted pan-India, but have actually been taken to other countries, which is just really nice to see.
So let's kind of dive a little bit into Magic Bus. Why don't you tell us what were the challenges, what was the organization trying to do, and just walk us through the early days of that one organization.
Sure. So this was an organization at the time started by Matthew Spacey, who had been living in India for about 8-9 years by then. He was COO of Cox and Kings, which is a travel agency. And on his own, he wanted to do something more for India. In fact, his first time coming to India was right after the Bhopal gas tragedy. And so he saw this tragedy. He himself is not of Indian origin, but saw this tragedy on TV. He was really wanting to help out, and so raised some money from friends and family and came to India, in fact, and went straight to Bhopal to see if he could make a difference. At that time, unfortunately, there was not much somebody from the outside could do, so we ended up going to Calcutta and working a little with Mother Teresa's. And I think that experience, probably similar to what I had done with sort of the street children in Mumbai, really impacted him and wanted him, and made him sort of come back years later as a professional. And so while he was in Mumbai and he was doing, you know, quite well in his for-profit world, he wanted to sort of give back. And one of the communities that he saw right in front of him was communities that lived in and around a place called Fashion Street in Mumbai. And this is sort of right outside the Bombay Gymkhana. And so Matthew was actually playing rugby for the India team at the time and practicing there. And he would see these kids watching him play. And he felt really guilty of why was he playing sort of rugby and kids were not allowed to play in the same field. And that was really the start of Magic Bus, which is how do you engage youth and children with something that they care about, but then through that teach them life skills, which are critical in them keeping jobs, being you know, proper family members and leaders in their own community.
Wow. And so how easy was it or hard was it to get funding as you guys started? This is a very different concept, right, at that time, and people must have wondered, you know, what is the impact? How did you sell Magic Bus to other potential investors slash donors?
Yeah, and so I guess, and honestly, the same holds true now, 16 years later, is demonstrating this sort of R&D of your program. And so very quickly, Magic Bus was able to hire a small team, two or three people, but really invest in creating curriculum according to different age groups and testing that out in different communities across the city. So within 3 years, they went from sort of 50 children on a monthly basis they were working with to close to 1,500 children on a weekly basis. And so their, I guess, capability of just demonstrating that they were in the field, bringing funders, corporates, foundations there on a weekly basis to demonstrate and see what was happening firsthand, and sort of the humility of saying that they didn't have all the answers. They were looking for sort of strategic partners to bring more of the methodology on whether it was impact assessment or child counseling or even, you know, more of the specific issues around sexual reproductive health or domestic violence, things that were quite common in these communities. They were very open in partnering with a large array of players, and I think that openness allowed more people to sort of believe and to a certain extent co-create this model with Matthew Spacey and his team, which I think, again, is something that most organizations that are successful are able to do from very early on.
Terrific. So, folks, don't go away. We'll be right back after a short break. Hello again. This is M.R. Rangaswamy with Indiaspora. I'm here today with Deval Sanghvi, the co-founder of Dasra. So, Deval, I know we talked about some of the early investments you made in organizations like Magic Bus and Akshaya Patra, and now, you know, you look back and these organizations are making great impact on India. They've put together a global model and so forth. So let's talk about Dasra itself. So you get started roughly 16 years ago. So take us through the evolution of Dasra. I mean, so initially you were working with some of these startups and trying to figure out how they could scale and make an impact. How did you evolve your own organization?
Sure. So we in addition to working with startup organizations over time, we started working also with what we would call in the business world, I guess, mid-caps. And this is sort of in sort of the mid-2000s, I guess, the mid-caps were organizations that were around 5 to 7 years. Their budget was close to, let's say, 50 lakhs. And so they had a proven track record. They were already in communities with an intervention. Yet what happened was they were sort of stagnating at that similar budget level. And the reason for that was the capital which came to them were either friends and family or individuals who were, of course, believing in the entrepreneur, but also had this belief that when they fund NGOs, they wanted to fund them only to get to a certain stage And then they wanted to look for what they saw as needier NGOs. And so once you get to sort of the 50 lakh to a crore level, they'd say, okay, well, we don't need to fund you anymore. You have enough money, and I'll go now to the earlier stage organization. And so we saw there was a large number of nonprofits that were sort of stagnating at the 50 lakh to a crore level. And that's what has made us realize that while early capital was actually starting to trickle in for startups and groups like Unlimited India, for example, were formed to really work with startups, or even Vilgrow, for that matter, that we helped incubate, that looked at early stage funding. No one was really looking at the mid-cap level and how do you get the 50 lakh to a crore organization to the 3 to 5 crores, which clearly enable them to reach out to sort of from the hundreds to the tens of thousands, which is required for India, as we know. And so our own model sort of started to evolve in understanding sectors more. And so, for example, looking at domestic violence, analyzing close to 200 organizations across India that focuses on preventing domestic violence, coming out with the top 5, 10, 15, and then providing them not only managerial support to build business plans, but then access to capital to see them scale more effectively. And so I think we became more focused on sort of understanding sectors and looking at this mid-cap range of organizations, and then still, of course, providing the much-needed hands-on support, enabling them to sort of get to the next level, which allowed larger funders to come in and support their work over a longer period or extended period of time.
Super. And so then when did you think up of the concept of the philanthropy forum, if you will, to kind of get the whole ecosystem together? What was your thinking behind that?
And so that happened around 2009, 2010, so sort of 10 years after we were spending quite a bit of time working with these organizations, understanding sectors, et cetera. We realized a lot of our knowledge, unfortunately, was sort of in a vacuum, and somebody had to visit our office, they had to spend time with us, mm-hmm. and that's the only time we had actually the time or the ability to share our learnings, our mistakes, our challenges, and sort of what the sector was going through, and we realized that there was a real need to sort of short-circuit that process or circumvent, I guess, the sort of initial 5 to 7 years where a donor would make funding decisions, make some mistakes, and then somehow find out that there's this group called DSRA that can help guide their capital more effectively. We wanted to sort of not have donors spend that kind of time, 5 to 7 years, in making those sort of mistakes or doing things on their own, honestly, and find us even before then. And that's when we decided to launch what's now in the DSRA Philanthropy Week, which is really bringing various funders, foundations, corporates, and well-established social entrepreneurs on the same platform, not to brag about the percentage of what they give, but more importantly to talk about the challenges as well as some of the successes that they've had and really create a marketplace where funders and givers, I guess, can learn from those who receive this kind of support. And over time, we've included, for example, consulting firms like Bain & Company now actually releases each year the State of India Philanthropy Report at our event. And I think that just brings a lot more methodology and rigor to what's happening in giving overall. And it's created really a safe space for funders to sort of work with each other and collaborate to create greater impact.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I have to commend you on that, because I think till you started the philanthropy week, I don't think people were realizing how to make an impact or the way they would give or who were different players in the ecosystem. So I think that was truly needed, and I know now it's become like the go-to event in India. So congratulations on that. And
Thank you.
And so then I think you've also gone into somewhat of a more formalized program called the Giving Circle. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that means and how you thought of forming it and what the Giving Circle does?
Sure. And so, again, this was around the time we launched Lester Philanthropy Week. We also were very concerned of creating sort of an event that was at a nice venue, et cetera, should not just be a talk shop for people to come to spend the day in and then feel like they did their philanthropy for the year. And so we really wanted to guide action. And so what we started doing around the same time was creating or open sourcing, I guess, our research. And so, for example, we did a report in 2011 on toilets and sanitation. This was much before Prime Minister Modi came into power and started talking about Swachh Bharat. And we had already done some reports on education, malnutrition, and realized that toilets in itself had, was such a root cause issue. You know, the number one reason why girls drop out of school is lack of toilets. The number one reason why children fall ill, and we have 1,600 children dying every single day still in India under the age of five, is because of the fecal matter that enters into the water supply, again, due to lack of adequate sanitation facilities. And so when we did this report, and our the way, I guess, our Giving Circle process works is we first would analyze, like I said, close to 200 organizations, spending 9 months speaking to experts, government officials, foundations, to really get a lay of the land, figure out where impact is being created, and analyzing some of the business plans and existing entrepreneurs that are in these spaces to see if they're, in essence, investment ready. We then take this data and book build and get a minimum of 10 individuals coming together, each committing now I think in dollar terms, it's close to $50,000. And so we have 10 people, $50,000 each. So there's $500,000 that gets collected. And these group of investors, in essence, act like LPs, where they hear sort of a shortlisted group of organizations present to them, and then collectively they decide which organization gets the $500,000 worth of capital, coupled with close to 200 to 300 days of hands-on support that the Dasra team provides to that organization over a 3 to 5 year period to really see them scale and grow.
Amazing. So that's one of your newer platforms, if you will. So what else, as you look out at Dasra, you've been at it 16 years. Where would Dasra be when it's 25 years old? What's your vision? What are your goals?
Yeah, well, I mean, in fact, today itself, we launched or finished the first workshop for corporates, nonprofit leaders, and government officials in partnership with Harvard Business School. And so we had Kasturi Rangan, a phenomenal professor at HBS, actually come to Mumbai, and he just facilitated a three-day course with various individuals, 65, in fact, participants came together to learn about effective partnership building, effective giving, and how to really measure that impact and create greater scale in the country. And so we see ourselves, I guess, finding more non-traditional players like Harvard Business School to participate in the development agenda in India. And that's just one example of hopefully many, many more players who will start coming onto a similar platform, because I think everyone realizes if you want to, for example, solve the 70% of individuals in Maharashtra alone who don't have access to individual toilets, or the 56,000 women who die every single year when giving childbirth, you can't do it alone. And so we see ourselves creating sort of these platforms or these ecosystems around different topic areas, whether it's empowering adolescent girls or improving in the governance and accountability of the government and how it functions, or even looking at sanitation and making sure there's sort of a closed loop with not just the building of the toilet, but the reduction of fecal sludge management or fecal matter into our water system. We see ourselves sort of creating these platforms, backing it with evidence-led data, and partnership opportunities, and then really forging those initiatives or partnerships to scale and grow.
I know, you know, Bill Gates has been quite active in India, trying to get the giving pledge going and so forth. What are your thoughts on that? Is that an idea that you could be part of in getting, you know, the high net worth and the rich Indians to kind of participate more actively and formally in giving back?
We've definitely been very fortunate to work with some of the leading families in the country and enable them to create greater impact by either using our research, creating partnership opportunities, or forging greater alliances. And so just in the last couple of years, we've worked quite closely with Rohini and Nandan Nilekani, the Azim Premji Philanthropic Initiatives, the Tata Trusts, the Piramal Foundation, in fact, is a huge supporter on the empowerment of adolescent girls, the Godridges, the Forbes Marshall Group. And so there has been a large number of these philanthropists that we actually work quite closely with now and really create safe zones or platforms for them to come together, learn about a particular sector, and create stronger investment strategies as they move forward. And so we're seeing a huge uptick from Indians. And in fact, we're quite confident in the next 5 years, you'll actually see greater amounts of capital from India flowing into these organizations than even what they get from outside the country, which I think is just a phenomenal testament of not only the wealth that we've created in our country, but the responsibility that these individuals are taking quite soon after liberalization of the economy. And I think people don't realize that as well. I mean, Bill Gates, for example, and Buffett, you know, gave away their wealth or are giving their wealth sort of 112 years after the Industrial Revolution in America. Yeah. And I think in India, we need to realize the wealth is still fairly new. And for them to part with that so quickly is quite admirable and something we should celebrate, as opposed to many times being scorned in the media as they don't give enough.
And what's your early take on the CSR rule in India? Is that going to be very helpful? Is that just a mere kind of showcase of what people can do? What's your early take?
Early sense was, at least in our minds, that it would take 3 to 5 years for it to come to sort of fruition. That being said, again, in this Harvard course that we were fortunate to participate in these last couple of days, we had actually the architect and the author of the law, Dr. Bhaskar Chatterjee, actually came and spoke yesterday, and he said, for last year, which is the first year the law has been enacted, 250 companies in India have given between 6 to 7,000 crores. Hmm. And so we're looking at $1 billion of unlocked capital from just 250 companies. And so I think that makes us really bullish that funds are actually moving. You know, the estimation was 20,000 crores or close to $3.3 billion, and that will take time. I mean, all laws, regardless of the country, take at least 3 to 5 years to build. I mean, we're seeing that with Obamacare and other laws as well in the U.S., but I think it's quite bullish. And again, having 65 participants in this course that HBS just offered in India, I think also demonstrates that people not only want to do it, but they want to do it well. And so they're willing to invest time and energy to learn from their peers to really create stronger strategies, because poverty is in their face. And like, you know, the example that you brought up earlier, they see it every time they step out of the house. And I don't think anyone in our country, feels that they've done enough. They're just questioning how they can do it more impactfully. And hopefully laws like this and forums like the Duster Philanthropy Forum, et cetera, can create those partnership opportunities and create just more transparency on what's happening overall.
So it looks like you, Deval, you're having a lot of fun. Your passion and conviction comes through. So any regrets leaving the United States, leaving a cushy, great job in New York with tons of money and making your way to India? Any regrets at all?
No, none at all. I mean, I think it's just been a fabulous ride. I mean, our children were born in this country. They're very, very Indian, yet still have the opportunity to see my parents in the U.S. every couple of years. And honestly, globalization and how I guess what we've experienced in the last 16 years in India has just been phenomenal in terms of the growth, the access to what's happening in the West, but still being grounded in what's happening in India. And so I really do think, at least living in a city like Mumbai, you do get the best of both worlds. And I think my kids, whenever you take them back to the U.S., the fact that after sort of 4 to 6 weeks, they're like, Mama, Papa, let's go back to India, I think makes us feel really good that, you know, the world has changed, and it's nice to be able to get access to everything here, which is, just absolutely phenomenal.
And what do your parents think? You know, they take the hard step of migrating from India to the U.S. only to find their son is back in India.
Yeah, no, it took them a while, I think. Understandably so. I mean, I think all parents want to be near their children, so just like they made the shift, it was hard for and their parents, I'm sure, it was difficult. It's the same thing. But, you know, very quickly, once they saw the work we were doing on the ground, and I think that was really the ethos that they raised us with and the value system. And so once they saw the work we were doing, it was very hard for them to say it, no. In fact, my older brother moved out to India about 5 years ago and has been actually working with USAID now. So both of us actually live here while my parents still live in Houston, Texas. So I think on one hand, they're very proud and they feel that we're doing stuff, honestly, for India that they wanted to do, I'm sure, when they left the country. But given the circumstances of being first-generation immigrants, they just couldn't, and they had to focus on our upbringing. And so to a certain extent, we feel, or we hope, we're sort of giving back for what they actually gave us. And I'm sure they wanted to do the same in India, but they just couldn't do so in that time period.
Right, right. So what do you do to relax? I mean, I know you know this kind of job is all-consuming. I know you have family and kids. What do you do to relax, Deval?
Honestly, spend time with our three boys, which is a little crazy. We have three boys, ages 10 and twins that are 9.
Oh,
so it's not
God.
Relaxation, but it's definitely a change of mindset. Because when you're with them, you cannot think about anything else. The same way when we're at work, we cannot think about them. So I think having both as demanding is quite nice. And I think just being in India and, you know, being able to make short trips to Ahmedabad or Kerala or Goa or whatnot is also really nice to do and relax.
Fantastic. Deval, I really once again have to commend you for moving back to India, starting Dasra, getting your wife to show, you know, come and make that same commitment and have your kids there. So once again, congratulations and all the best.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Today's show is produced by Monica Patel. The theme music is by Rina Ismail, and the interlude is by Jahan Shah. So long, everyone.